We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Big Ben Strong is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. In the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
There you go. Good afternoon. It is 900 CHML in Hamilton. Hamilton Today and Big Ben on the board. He is spinning the Aretha Franklin, reason being her birthday, if she was still with us. 1942, this day, Memphis, Tennessee. Aretha Franklin is born, her brand of soul rooted in the church. She belts out gospel blues through her child in Detroit. First with Columbia Records, and that doesn't go much, or doesn't go too far. Then hits with Atlantic Records in the late 60s, and the rest, as the Queen of Soul, is paired with Jerry Wexler, famed Atlantic producer, and off they go. And Aretha Franklin's career takes off. We'll be playing a little bit of Aretha throughout the course of the afternoon. Feel free. Love to hear from you. Send us a note, Scott Thompson at 900CHML.com. Phone lines are always open. Talk, text, leave us your last word. Like to hear from you. Don't forget, 4 o'clock after the 4 o'clock news, the Justin Trudeau countdown calendar. Just how many days are there till the next election? Ooh, dog it, we can't wait. And then 5 o'clock, your chance to win with Hammerhead Trivia. How well do you know the history of this great city? All coming up after 5 o'clock, and your chance to win $100 in Lotto Max tickets. Dream to the max, baby. Your lottery tickets with Hammerhead Trivia coming up after the 5 o'clock news. All right. What is going on in the Hammer? Boy, lots of news coming out of City Hall. The encampment has been ordered to go. The encampment, as Dave Woodard said, is now grown to about 40 tents. I call them the Trudeau tents, and I know a lot of people don't like that. But, you know, when you're bringing in over a million people a year and you're stressing out already stressed systems, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, whether it's mental illness, whether it's doctors waiting for operations, whether it's housing, whether it's rent, it trickles all the way down. Right to the shelter space and the services that we offer those that are most vulnerable. So that's where we are. Don't have a solution, but I know how we got here and how to stop it from happening again. And we have to move forward. What that solution is, not sure. But City Hall has said that they've been ordered to go. We'll see what happens as this progresses. Trying again to get the organizer on a little later on this afternoon to talk about what is going on and give you an update there. All right, what else we got? The Ontario budget is coming out tomorrow. Got a little bit of a bonbon today. Ontario extending its 5-cent a liter gas tax cut to 2025 to next year. Justin, going to weigh in on that one? So, and the other thing that's developing in, you know, because there's been lots of chatter about how Doug Ford wasn't going to override municipal approval and allow, I don't know who decides then, when a house becomes a fourplex. Again, lots of room for discussion, lots of room for compromise, but I'm not sure that fourplexes without municipal approval, who then approves it, is really the way to go. And I think as we dissect this more and more, we realize that let's start with three and we'll see where we end up. Again, cutting to red tape, but on the other hand, the approval process, it can be trimmed down, but there still has to be one there. All right, what else we got? UK and US have accused China of spying. They got a spy campaign hitting millions in the two countries. They're concerned about that. And boy, Donald Trump, he just never goes away. And he went to a judge and they reduced his bond commitment that he has to make, to get himself, moving forward, the bond amount rather. And it was down from like $400 million to $175 million. And he's got 10 days to pay that. Again, whatever side you are on this, listening to him at the news conference, he is just babbling aimlessly, going from left to right, up to down, talking about everything, freelancing, as one reporter called it. and just making no sense whatsoever. So whatever his purpose is, whatever his message is, I'm not sure. But he got a reprieve today with the judge lowering the amount of money he has to pay the bond amount to $175 million, but then just went rambling in front of microphones, saying all kinds of things. He started talking about the borders and Joe Biden and how everybody's out to get him. And, you know, even phrases like, I wrote this down, bet I'm right. Man, I don't know. So anyway, again, whatever your political affiliation is, is this the best we can do on either side? But then again, you know, we can ask ourselves the same question right here. But anyway, we'll try to give you a bit of an update on that over the course of the afternoon. Eric Alper is going to join us this hour, talk about the Junos. Did you watch last night and what stood out for him? As well, more on the Winnipeg lab leak and where that is going. Oh, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation upset because, you know, many have talked about this, delaying the election even by a week, and that allows a whole pile of MPs to qualify for pensions. And I guess, you know, at the end of the day, well, everybody deserves to qualify for a pension, but to make a deal with another party and to extend the government for that purpose. And let's remember, how long has this been going on? And we're the story is that they're going to extend the election or trying or talking about it from October 20th, I believe it is, to another week after that. And that allows these MPs, including Jagmeet Singh, to apply for their pension after 6 years. So, man, I'm sure that's going to go over well. Maybe they can rename that, too. We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. And, of course, get you an update from City Hall and what is happening in regard to the tent encampment there. New polling from Abacus Data shows more of what the same of what we are seeing. And also talking about, again, one of the flip-flops the Prime Minister made, opening the doors, allowing over a million people in, and then putting caps on temporary students and caps, on international students, and then caps on migrant workers. So, again, one step forward, two steps back, arriving to the house fire with a bucket of water after the house is burnt down. We'll talk about that. And this is interesting, too. You know, we always talk about the divisiveness within the country and what fuels that. And we have a tendency to blame that on our politicians. You know, they're taking this party too far that way or that party too far this way or what have you. We're going to talk to Christian Laprec about divisiveness in Canada and how foreign actors fuel that fire to turn us against each other. That discussion coming up as well. Juno Awards last night. Eric Alper with us, publicist, music commentator here now. Eric, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am good. Just landed into Toronto about an hour and a half ago, and still have a little bit of salt in my mouth. Just from being in Halifax.
So what was the party like? What was the East Coast edition like?
You know, the last time that it was on the East Coast was a number of years before COVID, and there was a volcano that erupted, I think, on the other side of the world that stopped all of the planes from flying. And a kitchen party kind of just launched into it for a couple of days. That's what it's like in Halifax. It's such a great idea for the Juno Award to travel from city to city to city and give those people who are music fans and parents and kids who are music fans or who are in music schools to see their favorite stars and celebrities and musicians up close when maybe they don't get a chance to see it if it was only in Toronto or only in Vancouver. So yeah, they came to party and it was excellent. And you know, everybody was just so happy to be in Halifax.
I agree. I think it's the best thing they could have done to move this thing around. And not only for the reasons you've just said, but it also highlights all parts of the country and the creative industries in those areas and such. Anne Murray opening up the show. Speaking of how this show has evolved, there was a time when Anne Murray wouldn't go anymore.
Yeah, you know, it was funny because, you know, people like me in the media and publicity people hang out with one another for days. And we talk to the people from the Juno Awards all day and all night. Nobody nobody revealed the fact that Anne Murray was going to be
really
there. So that was an amazing surprise. And she talked about how she was at the very first Juno Awards where there was less than 200 people and the organizers' mothers made sandwiches and the whole thing was over in 40 minutes. Mm. That's how far that the Canadian music industry have come, where, you know, some of the biggest award winners from the last two nights are some of the biggest artists in the world. You have Nelly Furtado going at yet another comeback this year. Tate McRae picking up a couple. The Beach Boys are easily one of the world's most popular rock bands. Charlotte Cardin wins for Album of the Year. Talk from Ontario, he won for Breakthrough Artist of the Year, and he's been on U.S. television for the last couple of months as well. And Karen Alua, who is the first Punjabi singer-rapper to take home the Fan Choice Award and the first Juno Award, period. So these people are getting really big, really fast, in not the traditional ways that you and I used to grow up on, which is tour, like the Tragically Hip, make videos like Blue Rodeo, perform everywhere like Jan Arden. They're not doing that kind of stuff anymore. They're really utilizing social media to their benefit.
And there's so many generations of music now since, say, the Anne Murray days, the Murray McLaughlins, the Gordon Lightfoots, which were the three staples.
Yeah, and I think one thing that the Juno Awards does really, really well, because certainly when you are the Grammys, you can basically, have everybody at your call and beck. Mm. And when the Junos happen, they have to be really, really careful to make sure that the heritage of Canada is well represented by hip-hop and R&B and trap music and LGBTQIA and Indigenous music and other world and global music as well. So it's a really tough show to line up, because you can't just have, a mixture of nothing but old people, because they're not, they're not the demographic anymore of the advertisers. So they did it really, really well by having Maestro Fresh West getting inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame. We all grew up with him.
Yeah, that makes me feel old right there, Eric. Yeah,
I know. And Jim Cuddy did the introduction to the In Memoriam with, some newer artists like Alison Russell performing. So there was a really good mixture, I think, for something for everybody.
So with that, and I really don't need to ask this, state of the Canadian music industry since those days to now. I mean, you pretty much described that with, 200 people in a hotel room and homemade sandwiches to what we have now. How can they keep evolving this? Because many commented on how even the Oscars show in the last year or so has stepped it up, has done something different as opposed to just people ripping open envelopes and making presentations and such. Are we seeing that out of the Junos?
You know what was amazing, and I'm so glad that you asked this, was on the red carpet, people in the media were not asking questions of the boring kind to the artists who are walking the red carpet. Everybody's trying to go viral. So they're doing quizzes, they're doing games, they're asking ridiculous, funny, but amazing questions. So while, music consumption is up 11.5% last year, it's just over $660 million of an industry in this country. It's a rise of almost 16% year on year. There's a new wave of how music and artists are being consumed. So definitely, I wouldn't ask Anne Murray a silly, goofy question, but you can definitely ask that to somebody like Maestro Fresh West or, the Beach Boys, because they'll just gladly play along with it because it's fun for them too.
Eric Alpert with us, music publicist and commentator, last night's Juno Awards 2024 edition of Eric, as always. Thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you so much for having me. We'll talk soon.
A military veteran, what is this? What is it with Winnipeg? Whether it's the lab situation there and the secrecy around who's coming and going, and now a military veteran who spent 20 years in uniform now lives on a quiet street in Winnipeg. He didn't serve in Canada's armed forces, was a member of the Chinese People's Liberation Army, according to records obtained by Global News. Before arriving in Canada in 2021, he worked for the Military Academy of the Chinese Cyber Security Warfare, the Chinese Cyber Warfare Department that hacks Canadians and steals their secrets. Chinese state-sponsored cyber attacks have targeted Canadian companies, activists, and government agencies. 3 years ago, this person obtained permanent residence in Canada and moved into a newly built suburban home in Winnipeg. To talk more about all of this and other related activities, Charles Burton with a senior fellow, Center for Advancing Canada's Interests Abroad at the McDonald Laurier Institute, and here now. Charles, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott. Good to speak with you.
Your thoughts on this, and what's with Winnipeg? Any relation to the lab, or why, or am I just barking up the wrong tree here?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, if you have been serving in the Chinese Communist Party's People's Liberation Army, which that army does belong just to the party, not to the state, and especially if you've been working in a cyber espionage unit, then I would say when the Canadians are deciding, should we give you a visa to come to Canada or not, the answer is probably, sorry, no, you know, that you don't qualify. You know, it may be that the gentleman who said that he wanted to move to Canada because he heard the air was better in Winnipeg than in Beijing may have had some basis, and maybe he's decided to put his spying days behind him. But the bottom line is that, you know, people with that expertise, resident on our soil, potential sleeper agents for future activation, you know, like it's just nuts that we would be spending a lot of time going over whether this is a good idea or not. Clearly it isn't. Lots and lots of people want to move to Canada. Of course, we have the greatest country in the world. We can't take them all. We have to be selective. And I would say filtering out people who have backgrounds in cyber espionage working for a foreign army are probably among the ones that we would just have to say sorry to.
You know, my next question, Charles, is how does this happen? Why not a red flag? But this is just more of the same, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't understand why it is that we can't seem to keep on top of this stuff, or whoever it is within the government who's decided that we should, you know, be accepting of people who have Chinese military backgrounds who infiltrate into our society. You know, is it incompetence or is there something darker behind that? It's very hard to say. And why Winnipeg? I don't know. I mean, it's mosquitoes in the summer and really hot and about as cold as any place on earth that you can imagine. But people who live there love it. So, you know, who knows? Maybe there is a Winnipeg, something about Winnipeg that attracts Chinese spies.
Who does decide this? You pose that. Who does decide?
Well, I mean, we do have a process for assessing visa applications from China. Most of the processing is done in New Brunswick, but, you know, they apply through the Canadian Embassy in Beijing or one of our consulates in Shanghai, Guangzhou, Hong Kong, et cetera. You know, and a decision is made based on set criteria and prudent judgment on the part of the immigration officer. And you know, when you turn them down, of course, there are always appeals and letters written to parliamentarians saying, why have you been as unfair not to allow my relative or friend or fiance or whatever, you know, applicant to engage in high-level research at our level 4 lab have been refused a visa. But, you know, for the most part, I think we just have to be much more skeptical of applications that come from countries where the governments are actively hostile to Canadian interests and with whom we could be involved in a future war, particularly if those persons have military backgrounds.
So where does this story go? Where does this case go? Is this just another one to put on the pile?
Well, I mean, you know, the two scientists from the Winnipeg lab who apparently are now continuing to work in China for People's Liberation Army related institutions under assumed names, as discovered by work by the Globe and Mail, you know, have not been charged with anything. It seems hard to imagine. You would have thought either we would say, okay, we're charging them because they engaged in activities which violated Canada's security provisions that they were signatory to. Or we would say, we looked into the case and there's nothing there and we're not going to charge them. but we're left with like nothing. And in the case of this one, you know, I'm sure that they have a good lawyer who will evoke the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms or whatever, and may in fact be allowed to remain in Canada. You know, it's troubling to me that these matters are not taken a bit more cut and dried, and we close them off quickly and make it clear to applicants from foreign militaries that we're not going to allow you to make a new life in Canada because we just can't be clear about whether your background suggests you may be engaging in future illegal activities in our country.
Why were, how come the two Chinese scientists that were let go from Winnipeg and were not charged, how come they have new names back home in China?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, for me, the big question is, seeing as they were under investigation, how is it that we agreed to them leaving the country? You would have thought that you would have said, well, you got to stay here until we've sussed out whether you're going to be charged or not. I think that, you know, they're trying to keep a low profile there. But that being said, we know where they are. We know the names that they're operating under. But of course, now that they're in China and, you know, working on important research for the Chinese authorities connected to the People's Liberation Army, there's not much hope that we're going to be able to ask the Chinese government to please send them back to Canada so they can face charges for potential espionage on behalf of the Chinese state. So the whole thing is just impossible for me to process as to how we could allow this to happen and effectively say to foreign spies, don't worry, you know, whatever you do, you won't end up spending your life in jail in Canada.
A couple of seconds left, different headline. U.S., U.K. accused China over sweeping spy campaign that may have hit millions. Headline today, your thoughts?
I mean, that's what they do. And I think that artificial intelligence and these massive algorithms and supercomputers make it possible for them to collect the data of, you know, hundreds of millions of people and then to process that to find weaknesses in our system that they can exploit. It's scary stuff, Scott. I got to tell you, it's scary stuff.
Charles Burton with us, Senior Fellow, Center for Advancing Canada's Interests Abroad at the MacDonald Laurier Institute. Charles, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Take care, Scott. Good to speak with you.
You may have heard this, and, you know, there's been chatter about this for a while, that the time in which the election is being held, which is in October of 2025, October 20th, I should know this, I've got a countdown calendar, they're going to extend that a week in order to qualify a whole pile of MPs for pensions. Now, if you're a conservative, I guess you're safe. But if you're the other two parties, it doesn't look good for you. So they're talking about extending that. So win or lose, everybody gets a pension, which, you know, okay, I see the, you know, you want your pension, but at the expense of dragging this government out even longer. And is that the reason we have this agreement in the first place? Well, let's bring in Franco Terrazano, Canadian Taxpayers Federation Federal Director. He's here now. Franco, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hey, thanks for having me on today.
Okay, Franco, just when you thought it couldn't get any better, worse, whatever way you want to look at it, this is unbelievable.
It really is, hey. So the federal government announces some changes to the Elections Act to essentially push back the scheduled October 20, 2025 election back a week. Now, what's so curious about that? Well, MPs who were elected in 2019 aren't eligible for their 6 years of service to collect a pension until October the 21st. So the federal government says that it's pushing back the election a week because the election would fall on a religious holiday. Well, if you ask anyone on the street, I think Canadians would say, okay, well, if you're going to move the election, just make it a week earlier instead of a week later.
Yeah.
But what they're doing is pushing back the election so 80 additional MPs can collect the very lucrative taxpayer-funded pension.
Who does that involve that's prominent?
Well, the two most prominent are two ministers, Anita Anand and Stephen Guilbeault. And they also are going to rake in the biggest annual starting pensions, right? Because they're ministers, they had higher salaries. So Anand's starting pension will be about $49,000. Guilbeault's will be about $48,000. But folks, like, this even downplays just the cost to taxpayers, okay? So if 80 additional MPs, the total cost of those pensions are like $120 million over the lifetime. Now, I'm not silly. You know, I know that not all 80 MPs will lose their seats, But if even half of those MPs lose their seats, moving the election back 1 week will cost taxpayers tens of millions of dollars.
All right, I'm going to play devil's advocate here, Franco, and you can have with this what you will. But, well, you know, everybody deserves a pension. How are we going to get good leadership if we don't provide, remuneration for people who are wanting to do this and dedicate to the service? What's the big deal?
Well, Scott, I'm going to play devil's advocate right back on you. If that was the real reason, or if that was their stated objective, why didn't they just come out and say it? Why didn't they just come out and say it? Because the talking point from, let's just be honest, liberal ministers and the federal government has been that they're pushing back the election, not for pensions, but because of the religious holiday.
Yeah.
So if that was the real reason, then why didn't they say it? Because here's the fact, okay? Some MPs, after 6 years of service, they'll get a lifetime pension of more than $2 million. You hear that, folks? 6 years of service as a member of parliament, more than $2 million in lifetime pensions for some of these. But it's not just the pension. If you're not eligible for a pension as an MP, you get a severance. That base severance is $97,000. All former MPs, they also are eligible for a transition allowance of about $15,000. And it's not just that, because every single year, regardless of the struggles facing their constituents, they have been giving themselves pay raises, right? So since the beginning of 2020, they have taken, or on as of April 1, they will have taken their fifth pay raise.
Hmm.
So it's a whole suite of things that's just soaking the taxpayer here.
So where is this story now with extending the election? Is this happening?
Well, so what happened is they introduced legislation. Okay, so the legislation has not been passed. Last I checked, it was only in first reading. So there's going to be a heated debate. There is going to be heated debate on this. Now, a kudos, I guess, to the leader of the official opposition, Pierre Poilievre, because I have heard him speak out on this, not on the overall cost of pensions, but on the fact that it seems like the federal government is just trying to push back the election 1 week so more MPs can become eligible for the pension. But Scott, to answer your question directly, the legislation has been introduced. Nothing has become official yet. And I think there's going to be a lot of heated debate in the months to come.
How much does or does the deal between the NDP and the Liberals factor into all this?
Well, that's a good question. The honest answer that I can give you is I don't know. But what I do know is that this sure looks like and smells like the federal government, the governing parties, trying to push back the election so more of their MPs will get a pension. That's all I can say. That's what it looks like, right? And the last thing I'll say is, like, hey, politicians, if you don't want to look shady, don't do shady stuff like this.
Franco Terrazano with us, Canadian Taxpayers Federation Federal Director. Chatter of bumping back the election October of 2025 by a week so more can get pensions. Franco, thanks for the time. Be well.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
You might remember last week we talked to Angela Vaus, a property advocate and organizer of the City Hall camp City Hall forecourt encampment that we're seeing now. And at that time, having a meeting with the mayor, Andrea Horvath. And now we're hearing information that a notice of contravention has been issued to the organizers of the protest encampment out front of City Hall, requesting voluntary compliance and the removal of the site. To talk more about all of this, Angela Vaus, a property advocate, organizer of the encampment, and here now. Angela, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I am doing well. I hope you're good, too.
So, obviously, last time we chatted, you had a meeting with the mayor. Not a lot of progress made there. Did you expect this?
I didn't expect this because I thought I made myself clear about the trespass notice and the fact that we are an active protest and that is our right to do so. And we will stay for the duration of the time that we need to get housing for people and to continue on with the health care and the services that we've provided.
So this is a voluntary request, obviously the first step, I'm guessing. How do you react to that? What is your reaction?
My reaction is to get louder and to gang people together and lock arms in solidarity. So when they do show up to try to use enforcement, like they have suggested on the notice that we were given this morning, that we are not going to leave and we are not going to back down, and that people are going to get hurt because we are going to stand up for our rights and freedoms as our fathers have before us.
And we should mention that we have reached out to the city on this and have not heard back before the show. So, and we'll keep trying. So, obviously, you're not going to move voluntarily then.
No, we're not moving voluntarily. We have the right to be here, right? And we have the right to care for people that our society has turned their back on. And, you know, I moved here because I thought Andrea Horwath was going to make a revolutionary change, because I'd followed her patterns and knew who she was. And I'm seriously disappointed in the fact that she is just non-compliant, not even out here to see people, not even seeing what we're really doing. She did tell me I was doing a great job, but not willing to support in any way.
What was your request to her? What did you need for this?
I asked her for toilets. I asked her for power, and just general holistic care for these people, right? So, I mean, it's not really a lot to ask for. I think I've asked for very minimal, considering some of these people have been moved out of their locations 12 or more times and just left out in the cold on the some of the coldest nights of the year with nothing. Because all in the garbage, right?
Anything, Angela, on another location or an alternative? Has that been put forth? Like, what happens if you're removed from there? What is the alternative if they offered options?
They have suggested a couple of different locations. I've looked at the locations. I know that they're not so safe locations. And I also know that a lot of the people that have come in the last few days are coming from those locations, because they're even preventing people from going in there with food and harassing people that are trying to support other people at the compound at Pier 4 and at other locations as well.
And you're saying it's safer, for example, in the City Hall forecourt than it is in the alternatives they're giving you?
Absolutely. They're visible here. People can see what's going on. We're on camera 24/7, and they have security that walks around every hour. Not only that, but we actually have a private, like they have a bathroom in City Hall that people can use for private things that they have to deal with medically, and can do that, right? So, I mean, there's nothing like that in other locations that they're even offering people. And I feel like they're trying to murder them, because they know that some of these people need health care.
What are those other locations? What are the other options?
The other options are other locations like the Pier 4. There's another encampment set up.
Other encampment sites.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And we know already that those are not safe encampment sites. They're not monitored 24 hours a day, and that really bad things are happening to people in those places.
Wow. How much time do you think you have, Angela, before they move in? What are your next steps?
I don't know. I believe that they're going to come back at midnight. They're going to try to do something. We're just going to keep rallying as many people together. And as the week progresses on, we're just going to keep filling up the space. And we're going to fight back. We're not taking this. It is our constitutional right to protest, and especially to care for other humans that are Canadians that deserve the care and respect of their society, right?
So are you going to fight back physically? Like, is this going to get violent?
Well, does it need to defend myself?
Yeah, but does it need to leave?
Just like they're going to tell me to leave and I'm going to leave. That's not going to happen.
So what needs to be done, Angela, in order, like what point do you have to get before you go, okay, we'll move this or remove this encampment? What do you need to see happen? Because those sound like pretty long-term goals.
Yeah, they are. And they were not originally long-term goals, but the pushback and what I've seen for healthcare, I mean, even Hep C that is untreated. Now, this is a problem for all of the community, right? And other things that are going on here that are contagious need to be contained, they need to be addressed, and they need to know where people are to do that. And when they're spread out all over the city of Hamilton, they're not getting that. People lose their pills, their bags get stolen, they don't have medications. It's an ongoing cycle of turmoil, not only for them, but for society, because these things are dangerous for everyone, right?
Angela, last... we've only got a few seconds left, Angela, but you said last time we spoke that you were moving on to another crisis, another situation. Are you going to stay there longer as a result of this, or what?
I'm hoping that we can staff this properly and get some strong-minded people, and that we can keep moving this forward and opening up more places, because really, obviously, my voice is not loud enough in one place, and we need to amplify the voice all the way across Canada, that we don't want any more tents.
Angela Voss with us.
My homes.
Angela Voss with us, poverty advocate, organizer of the encampment, notice of contravention issued to the organizers of the protest encampment in front of City Hall. Angela, thanks for the time. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
New polling from Abacus shows a continuation of more of the same. I guess no surprise there. But the Liberals have certainly put on a massive communications push, trying to sell the carbon tax, trying to say to us that if we cut the carbon tax, you'll get your check cut. All that sort of stuff. Is it making any sort of an impact? Let's bring in Eddie Shepherd, Vice President Insights at Abacus Data, and here now. Eddie, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
You too, Scott. Thank you.
So, Eddie, any changes on what's happened with the push for the Liberals trying to sell the carbon tax, changing the name, repositioning it and such, trying to re-educate us on that? Is it working?
In a short answer, no. We're basically seeing that the gap between the Liberals and Conservatives, it's remained stable since the start of the year and really for the past few months now. So I think we're at a point now where this is kind of the new normal. And the fact that nothing has changed is showing that people just aren't listening to Trudeau anymore. And what's being put out there, the messaging, it's just not cutting through.
Are you surprised to see Conservatives gaining ground in places, provinces that they normally weren't?
I think at this point now, the regional differences remain stable throughout. So, you know, at first it was a bit surprising, but the fact now it's been a consistent lead regionally outside of Quebec for a while now. So I think their messaging is working because it's hitting home to what mattered to Canadians right now. And it's the cost of living, it's housing, it's affordability. And we found early in December that, you know, when they stray from that messaging, things do shift a little bit, but they've been pretty consistent now talking about the things that matter most. And it's really influencing the polls.
And it seems that every province, except for, like you said, for Quebec, it seems to be favoring the Conservatives.
And regionally, as well as age differences right now. So right now, you know, the Conservatives have a pretty sizable lead across all provinces outside of Quebec and across all age groups. So I think the real test for them now is to really figure out, can they solidify this, I guess, new coalition, as we're saying, that they've built across demographics and regions. So for them, it's really, you know, hammering home the messaging they're currently doing to really retain that kind of voter support. And it's likely the new normal now in terms of this. We've seen a 17 to 18 point gap for a few months now. So it's a matter for the Conservatives to really stay consistent and make sure they're really gaining the confidence of this new coalition.
Let me ask you, just out of left field here, Eddie, your thoughts on if the Liberals, they're considering extending the time to the next election in order to qualify MPs for their pensions. Just with what you've seen, how do you think that's going to land?
Yeah, right now we're not really too sure on that front. So when you think about the next budget being released, I think following that, there'll be some significant shifts in terms of when the next election is and some conversation around that. As of right now, though, I think that, you know, the support is really weak for the Liberals. So for them to really make any shifts in that, I don't know if it's the right time necessarily to do that. And looking past the next budget release, that's when I think we'll start to see things really shape out.
What about voter turnout? Many have talked about whether, you know, because people want change, or if people want change, does that mean a high voter turnout? Or when it appears to be more one-sided than another, that the other will stay at home and rather not vote than vote for somebody they don't want to? Any sort of prediction on what voter turnout might be this time around?
I think right now we're setting a fairly strong voter turnout. And when you look at what's happening right now, people, as you said, they come out to vote when they want change, or if they think that their vote won't really necessarily matter, they'll stay home. And I think in both cases, that really helps support the conservatives because, you know, they would be obviously the change. And with the sizable gap in the committed vote right now, there may be people who sit at home and think, well, my vote won't impact things. And I think that's up to the Liberals for the next year to really try and make as much as they can with their messaging and try and make them look more focused and effective and transparent. That's what's really missing right now, we're seeing in their messaging.
So you think the idea of change will equal a high voter turnout this time out?
Absolutely. It's been a rough, you know, year and a half, 2 years now. And we released a poll last week that looked at people's outlook for 2024. And it's quite negative across all things in terms of personal finances, the housing situation, even political uncertainty. So I think that people right now are looking for change and they're looking for leadership who can help them steal that change. And at the current set, it's in their minds, the conservative government potential.
I'm not sure whether, Eddie, you can answer this and stay neutral, but is it better for the Liberals if they go sooner rather than later, or even the NDP for that matter, and separate themselves from the Liberals?
Yeah, I think right now it's going to take a drastic shift from the Liberals and the NDP to make up any ground right now. So I think it's a matter of right now the Conservatives kind of stay in the course and making sure they keep their current messaging, and the Liberals really need to try and reset and regain the public's attention. And how they do that, you know, there's a few ways they can, and I think we'll start to see that following the next budget release, but they really need to try and find ways to reach the audience, because right now, you know, whatever they're doing, it's just not working whatsoever in the minds of Canadians.
That being said, Eddie, can then you predict what this budget would have? I mean, if nothing's going to stick, what do you do?
Well, I think, you know, we saw Minister Fraser last week talking quite a bit about the housing situation, how the next budget really needs to have a significant amount of, you know, conversation around that. So I think that is obviously the one thing that really impacts all Canadians, regardless of what your current situation is. Housing really is at the center of everything. So I do expect there to be a significant amount with respect to housing in the next budget, because that is definitely one area where people are impacted significantly. And I think it can help improve the messaging for the Liberals. But outside of that, it's really, they need to try and be more focused and show Canadians that it's, you know, they have the right things in mind for the public mindset.
How much has housing been an issue to the change in voting intention by age? I mean, normally younger people have a tendency to vote for the prime minister. He's had those in his wake for a long time. We're seeing 18 to 29, still strong support for the conservatives. And then 34 to 44, 45 to 59, 60 and over. It's all pretty consistent, but still that younger age group is still, how big of a factor could they be in the next election, 18 to 29?
I think it'll be a huge factor. When you look at when Trudeau and the Liberals took power in 2015, it was largely on the backs of the younger audience. And, you know, we continually are surprised by the fact that right now it's the 16 and over who are most likely to support Liberals. It's not the younger demographic at all anymore. And now I think we're seeing that group shift to the conservative committed vote just because, you know, they're largely the ones who are out of the market. They're priced out, they're left out, and they feel a significant degree of uncertainty. So I think right now, when you look at that younger audience, you know, it had a significant effect in 2015 when the Liberals first took power. And we're really seeing that shift now towards the conservatives and likely going to have a similar effect in the next election.
Do you see or anticipate this changing? I mean, we've still got a long way to go till the next election, 574 days. If it's not, it can bump back another week. Do you just expect that this will just be rowing right along at the same pace 500 days from now?
So I think what it's tough to say, because right now we think the conservative committed vote has kind of peaked. So yeah, it's been relatively stable for a while now. And I think that, you know, right now 2 in 5 of the committed vote are going to the Conservative Party. And I think there's an opportunity for the Liberals to try and regain some of that ground. If you look back just 1 year ago from today, it was only a 2-point gap between the Liberals and Conservatives. So a lot can change in a year. And we've already seen that happen. So when you think, you know, as you said, over 500 days next election, you know, it could shift again, but the Liberals are facing a significant communication challenge right now where people just aren't listening. So I think, you know, Paul Leavitt and the Conservative Party really need to focus and stay consistent. And the Liberals just need to really try and rein in what matters most to Canadians, how to message and reach them, and try and cut through and regain some of that ground.
Eddie Shepherd with us, Vice President Insights at Abacus Data, the latest polling information. Eddie, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you, Scott. You as well.
The headline in the Bay Observer, more chaos at Burlington City Hall. Two senior staffers gone as councillors ready for a challenge to strong mayor's powers, says John Best. To talk more about all of this, John Best, publisher of the Bay Observer, here now. John, thank you for your time. Hope you're well.
Yeah, I am. Thanks very much, Scott.
So what's going on at City Hall in Burlington, and what does it have to do with the strong mayor's powers?
Well, under the strong mayor powers, the mayor has the ability to hire and fire not only the city manager, but also department heads. And Burlington has been struck with what appears to be, and it's been acknowledged even in staff reports, they've got a very serious problem with staff retention at all levels. They, you know, their city manager recently announced that he's leaving. They've now hired a new city manager to replace him. The head of communications, who used to head up communications for Hamilton, has he just quietly disappeared. The treasurer has indicated that she's done her last budget. The city solicitor was replaced last year, the city clerk as well. And there was a report put in front of council last fall that pointed out that something like 380 staff had left within two or three years of them being hired. And 380 staff in Burlington is, if they're all full-timers, would be almost 40% of their total staff. The report said that, you know, they had a lot of managers who only had 3 years or less experience. And they did an employee satisfaction survey that showed over a third of the workforce were not happy. And so some counselors, and then what really triggered it, as the headline suggested, just in the last few days, two more executive director level women that were heading up departments left the city. We don't know if they quit or if they were fired. But that seemed to trigger this motion by four of the councillors. There's only six councillors on Burlington's council, and four of them have called a special meeting for tomorrow. And they want the mayor to voluntarily relinquish the part of the strong mayor power that gives her control over hiring and firing senior staff.
So am I to understand this correct, John, that the mayor has been using her strong mayor's power and that's why this is happening, is interfering with other business? That's why these people are leaving. Has the mayor been using or exercising that strong mayor power?
We don't know that. I'm hoping that that will come out tomorrow. A lot of this has been brewing for quite a while, Scott, and a lot of stuff sort of through clenched teeth and people sort of not really saying what's going on. But it appears there, I think what we can say for sure is that with four councillors out of six asking for these changes, they feel the mayor has something to do with the departure of some of these senior staffers. And one of the councillors, Lisa Kearns, she referred in a meeting last week, she called it a climate of fear among managers. So the mayor didn't have much to say last week when she did try to have this meeting delayed, but she was overruled on that. Whether there will be a more fulsome explanation, I'm hoping there will be. I think this kind of hinting and sashaying around, it's time, whatever it is, let's get it out in the open would be my hope. And so it'll be an interesting meeting tomorrow, I think.
It's funny, when the premier announced all this, there were a lot of people, we're never going to use this, and a lot of them were on the left. Now it seems as if they're using it more quietly or secretly. We don't seem to be talking about it as much as when the premier first brought it up. Why are we not raising the red flags and pointing this out here, or are we?
Well, actually, these four dissidents in their preamble to their motion, they made the point that Mayor Marianne Mead Ward was one of those who said, I'm not really for strong mayor powers, I'm for strong councils.
I remember that.
Yeah, so she's going to be put to the test on that tomorrow, and it's a resolution to ask her to do this because there's no way of forcing her to do it. But if she, you know, if she goes against the majority of her council, then I think you're going to be looking at a pretty tense remainder of the term for this council.
You know, John, there's lots of debate over whether one should use strong mayor powers or not. I think what seems to be surprising here is a lack of transparency. It seems to be going on behind closed doors without people wearing their cape.
Well, the mayor actually has to post every time the strong mayor powers are invoked. However, anything to do with personnel is covered under the, you know, the usual regulation that we don't discuss personnel in public. And so, you know, if there is anything to do with personnel, and it may not be an out and out firing, it could just be a climate is created where people feel they need to leave and go somewhere else. There's, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that people are getting axed. It could be that, you know, the climate is just made so uncomfortable that they want to move on. And some of these people have pretty good reputations. They're, you know, they've been around for quite a while. Tim Camiso, the city manager, had many, many years with Burlington in previous positions. And then he was the city manager of Thunder Bay. He was up there for 7 years. So he's had a pretty successful career. And some of these other people that have departed as well, there doesn't seem to be any suggestion that, you know, that they weren't performing. So I think that's what's got the Burlington Council concerned. And they'd like to see that power revert to council.
John Best with us, publisher of the Bay Observer. The latest headline, more chaos at Burlington City Hall. Two senior staffers gone as councillors ready to challenge strong mayor powers, which evidently suggests that they may be being used. John, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
My pleasure.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
We certainly know the situation that has been caused with an overabundance of people coming into the country. And this is everything from international students to temporary workers or temporary residents, as well as typical migration that we see. The Prime Minister was warned a couple of years ago by immigration that you got to tap the brakes on these targets that were sending sectors into crisis because we just don't have the services. Too many people chasing too few services, whether it's housing, whether it's health care, doctors, looking for a family doctor, all of that, all the way down to the shelter system. You can't add that many people to the country in such a short period of time and not expect to exhaust systems. So now we've seen the federal government backtrack on this, first with international students, putting a cap on their own target there, and now with temporary residents, putting a cap on that in order to slow it down. Let's bring in Cassandra Fultz, regulated Canadian immigration consultant and founder of Doherty Fultz Immigration Consultants. And here now, Cassandra, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Hi, Scott. Thank you so much. I'm doing great. How are you?
So far, so good, Cassandra. How does this latest decision affect what you do and affect people coming and going from this country?
Well, I can tell you that what I do has not been normal since COVID, and now this is just the way it is. Wildly unpredictable decisions with considerable, let's say, lack of planning put into the behind them. So, yeah, it's not great for our business, and it's even less great for newcomers themselves. I have many stories that I can tell you of people who have invested thousands of dollars, years of their lives preparing to become permanent residents of Canada. And now with, you know, changes that happen with the stroke of a pen and zero planning, these people have no recourse and it's simply not going to happen for them. The government has absolutely pulled the rug out, not just from under Canadians, but under newcomers as well.
Was this needed? Did they have to slow this down?
Yeah, this was needed 10 years ago. It was needed, absolutely. But it needed to be done with a plan, with some kind of consideration of how is this going to, how is this policy change going to impact human beings, number one? How is this policy change going to impact universities, colleges, businesses? How is this going to impact our country as a whole? Because none of this was considered. This is absolutely a knee-jerk reaction in some pathetic attempt to keep voters from the mass exodus that's happening right now.
I think what frustrates people even more, Cassandra, is that the government was warned 2 years ago that they were heading for this mess. And yep. rather than pause it or come up with a plan, as you've suggested, they're now reacting and capping those plans. Why don't you think that this seems pretty common sense? You can't bring in more people than you have services. Why do you think this was ignored? How did this happen?
It's absolutely common sense, or at least it should be. To be honest with you, the only answer that I can really come up with is that maybe the people in charge at that time did not think it was actually that bad. And what you have to do is sort of put yourself in the shoes of the people who make those decisions. Consider the mentality of someone making decisions about immigration, about visas, who has never had to fill out a visa application themselves. They have no idea what goes into this. You know, we've only had one minister under this government who is an actual immigrant. One, literally one. And now we're deep in the pulpit with, like, I don't know, what is this, our eighth minister now at this point? The fact of the matter is they're making these decisions because they don't know how this impacts people, and they just think they know best just because they're there in power.
And I think what a lot of people don't realize too, Cassandra, is this cat's already out of the bag. So even if stop this, you still have to deal with now this juggernaut that's come through that you've got to play somewhere.
We'll be lucky if we see positive changes within a decade. It's too late. Like, it's already too late. We can't put this genie back in the bottle. Putting these caps on now, which is completely arbitrary. These numbers are completely arbitrary. These plans are completely not thought out one bit. It's going to hurt everyone. Everyone is going to continue to be hurt. We've already been hurt by this sort of lack of planning, by, you know, not having enough doctors, not having enough nurses, and not to mention the political issues of, you know, not paying them, not giving them raises, the mass exodus of doctors and nurses to the United States, because it's right there. We can't just pretend that it's not there when people want to go take an opportunity. And also tech workers, same thing. Anyone who can get a visa to work in the U.S. is. So, you know, what's left for us? We can't pretend like all of this hasn't happened. And it's not possible. Like, this plan, or lack of plan, this change, it's not going to do anything. You're still going to be waiting 18 hours in the ER. You're still not going to be able to find an apartment. It's not going to change anything.
Obviously, no quick fix for this. It's going to take a while for this to run through the system. What needs to be done, though, moving forward, Cassandra?
That's such a loaded question. I think what needs to be done is we need to construct a plan that actually works, that takes into account where we are now. We have to meet people where they are. And I think that's really part of the issue that caused this in the first place. Is some, you know, it's nice to have lofty ideals. It's nice to have goals. It's all very important. But what about where we actually are economically? What pieces do we have on the board? What cards do we have in our hand to play? And that's what's missing here, right? That's what's missing. We need to actually have real stakeholders who are impacted by these decisions, aka Canadians themselves, also known as immigrants, newcomers, people who are actually impacted, the businesses who are losing money, the schools who don't have federal funding, are losing provincial funding and turn to international students because the provincial government said, hey, find your own funding, right? We need to talk with the actual stakeholders and develop a plan, a solution that will work, not just some idea that's in the ether.
Yeah, Cassandra Fultz with us, regulated Canadian immigration consultant, founder of Doherty Fultz Immigration Consultants. Decisions made to cap the amount of migrant workers coming in and international students. It all has repercussions, just like when you open the floodgates in the first place. Cassandra, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
My pleasure. You as well.
You know, we've talked at length on this show for years about the divisiveness that is growing in Canada. Extreme politics where, you know, left or right, it was center left, center right. Now it's extreme left, extreme right. And the battle is on for someone to pick a team. Many of us have blamed politicians for this and winning elections as opposed to doing what's best for the country. But is it all political parties? Is it all political leaders? Or is there help? Is somebody fueling the fire? Are foreign actors doing their best to divide us, to provide us with information, misinformation, that is designed to do just that, divide a pretty much united country? Let's bring in Christian Leprecq, professor both the Royal Military College of Canada, Queen's University, and a fellow at the Macdonald Laurier Institute, author of the new book, Security Cooperation Governance, The Canada-United States Open Border Paradox, and Christian here now. Christian, thanks for the time. Hope we're well.
Well, it's a beautiful day, Scott. I sure am.
So, Christian, how much of this is domestic politics, just, you know, dirty politics? How much of this is fueled by outside foreign actors, outside foreign interference?
So, look, in a democracy, we want to have a vibrant debate, right? So this is what sets democracies apart, as opposed to authoritarian regimes that try to manage the message, autocratic regimes like the Putin regime that tries to channel everything into one single message. And the test for democracy often comes at the margins. So the ideas that sort of are challenging the status quo, you know, think, for instance, about women militating for the franchise 100 years ago or so, you know, so some of this can be very positive developments. And if you look back to the 19th century, I mean, this was a deeply divided country politically, with horrendous attacks by various groups against one another in the public sphere. But what we have today is the ability of social media to amplify those divisions in a multiplier way, a deliberate, I think, capitalization of certain political leaders and parties to focus not on what brings us together, but rather what divides us, which in Canada is inherently dangerous because, look, we're naturally a very divided country. Look at the geography, the religious divisions, the linguistic divisions, urban, rural. There's so many cleavages in this country that ultimately prudent politicians have always brought this country together. And then our adversaries leveraging various instruments, technological instruments, including social media, to amplify those divisions. And so what that ultimately does is undermine our social fabric, undermine our prosperity, undermine our democratic institutions. And that, of course, is the medium-term goal of our adversaries, to stoke those divisions and to make democracy look from the outside like it is dysfunctional. And look, our adversaries don't have to attack us kinetically if they can infiltrate our societies and basically undermine what brings us together as a society and as a country.
Do we understand this? Are we falling for this?
Well, my concern is, look, that I think Canadians and politicians are becoming a bit more aware of this. We're seeing some changes, in particular federally, in terms of posture and legislation. The problem is that the technological capabilities are multiplying exponentially. So if you think of, for instance, the data that are being gathered through TikTok, the way China can aggregate those data with all sorts of other data that they've gathered on Canadians, on Canadian society. You know, the 2016 interference by Russia in the US election is nothing compared to the tools that are available today in order. And then add to that artificial intelligence and the way China, for instance, deployed that on an industrial scale in the Taiwan election. And my concern is that the gap between the ability and willingness of politicians to address this and the capabilities of our adversaries continues to grow and grow exponentially. And so My worry is that even in a year or two, we'll be here and we wished we had done the right thing in terms of making sure that our society, institutions, economy would be more resilient. There are countries that are. Australia is a good example. Now, Australia is also facing significantly even greater challenges than Canada is in some ways. But look, our adversaries look for the weakest link. And on so many issues, Canada is emerging as the weakest link that's the easiest to exploit.
How do we unite? How do you change course so when this starts to happen, people are aware of it? I mean, you know, we have the attention span of a gnat. How do we understand this is happening?
Well, one of the problems is there's no votes in this, right? So making our society more resilient. The problem is when there's votes in it, it's kind of too late. It's when you get to the point where the society is so profoundly divided when people realize that, oh, we should probably do something about this. So one issue is that I think politicians need to be able to make decisions in this regard. They need to be able to commit. They need to be able to articulate those decisions, and they need to be able to justify and explain those decisions to the public. And look, when it comes to defense, intelligence, national security, it just seems that politicians on all sides of the spectrum have so far not been willing to do that. And I think that is an ignorance of the fact that this country is exposed to significant dimensions of hybrid warfare by our adversaries on a daily basis. And so what looks like fundamental disagreement, if you think of illegal and potentially criminal sort of attacks verbally on politicians, so the stoking of violent extremism at the margins in a democracy where the social contract stipulates that we will refrain from violence to advocate our political ideas and our political differences, that is very much in the interest of our adversaries and being stoked by our adversaries. So I think it's the violence, it's the illegalities that we should be profoundly concerned about. And where it seems that neither the institution, look, the institutions, we say police should enforce more. Police will take their cues from what politicians are prepared to tolerate. Yeah. And it seems that we have significant tolerance on all sides. And the only times we are actually willing to do things is when it happens to not be opportune with a political program of any one particular actor, rather than having a comprehensive strategy to protect this country and what has long made this country one of the most desirable places in the world to live and one of the most prosperous countries in the world.
As you alluded to, Christian, many are not interested. Many leaders aren't interested in this. Is this because perhaps it's an advantage for them? Are they losing sight of the big picture here?
Well, I think we're certainly missing a comprehensive strategy. We seem to get these one-offs. And when we get these one-offs, it's difficult to say, is this part of government trying to address what has been identified as a significant vulnerability in the system? Or is it government trying to silence certain voices that happen to be critical of one or more particular political parties? And so I think this is where we're not doing ourselves a favor by always having these sort of performative elements of legislation that political leaders and political parties love to introduce as a way of showing they're doing something rather than actually introducing a comprehensive strategy. Look, this government has introduced strategies on dozens and dozens of policy areas, but it seems that there's no comprehensive national security strategy. The National Security Council, as far as we know, that sort of this government has implemented, has met four times. Clearly, this is not a priority area. And so if we're going to, I worry about where we are headed and that by the time we wake up as a country, it is going to be too late in the sense that we will be so divided and we've been there before as a country. We know what a divided Canada looks like. Those of us who are old enough who think back to the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, the Quebec referendum. And I think, you know, most of us would say we overcame that due to political leadership. And what I'm missing is the political leadership to bring this country together and make it resilient.
Well said. Christian Leprecht with us, professor at both the Royal Military College of Canada and Queen's University, fellow at the Macdonald Laurier Institute, divisiveness in Canada. How much of it fueled by foreign actors? Christian, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you, Scott. Have a good afternoon.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.